Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Massive Match Day, presented by our dear friends at Land Grant Brewing Company and the Old North Arcade. It is a special extended edition this week. The Mothership podcast on Monday could not get off the launching pad, so Nathaniel and I are here to walk you through everything you need to know about last week's match in Bridgeview and everything you need to know about this week's match at Moffray Stadium against Toronto. Nate, how you doing?
Really good. Longer one today. I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to touching up on the recaps a little bit more and adding a few extra things in.
Yeah, sadly not a whole lot to talk about, though. Crew SC travel north just outside of the second city to take on the Fire. Historically not a place that's been too kind to the black and gold, and that continued this time. Kind of a sloppy goal to concede, and it was the only goal of the match. After the goal, the Fire just kind of bunkered up, really, and made it hard for Crew SC to play. So overall thoughts on the match?
Well, Columbus looked a team of parts. They didn't look the cohesive unit that we've seen from every match this year, which has been something that I and you have both applauded of Bertholder's team this season, and they significantly lacked that against Chicago. Chicago came out, they played well. They played to beat Columbus. They didn't come to play their game. They came out to counter what Bertholder was going to bring, whereas Bertholder came out to play his game. So I think in the end, it ended up being that Chicago countered Columbus, shut them down, and happened to get a goal.
You know, it's interesting that you point that out. I think we were both in agreement in the first match of the year. Bertholder got out-coached in that second half. The adjustments that Chicago made at halftime on opening day really kind of nullified everything Crew SC were doing well in the first half. I didn't think that Bertholder really got out-coached in this one in that fashion. I think he might have made a gamble in his lineup and what they tried to do from the off, and it just didn't work, and then he adjusted as best he could with the available players. Obviously, we'll touch on the injuries that the team are missing, but I don't necessarily agree with the thought that's come out here in the days since that Bertholder just got outcoached again. I think that he had a specific game plan in mind. He talked about it a little at practice on Monday or Tuesday, I believe. They wanted to try to tire out Schweinsteiger. They didn't think he could really go for the entire match, so they wanted to have that central midfield to really run down. You know, three defensive midfielders to kind of make Schweinsteiger work for it, McCarty work for it, and I just think that it didn't work. It wasn't necessarily a bad idea, maybe not the idea you or I would have gone with, but I can see the thought process behind it. But it just didn't work. I think that with three similar players all trying to play a new role, a role they weren't accustomed to, Abu in particular really looked out of sorts in that one. I just think he made a tactical gamble this week, as he's done in other weeks, and this one just didn't pay out.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you there. To touch on the Bertholder got outcoached. Thought, I understand what some fans are trying to say, I think, by saying that. I don't think they've articulated it properly. I think that he didn't get outcoached. It's just that Pano came out and played to beat Bertholder, like I said previously, and made changes throughout the match as the match developed, whereas Bertholder stuck to his guns and stuck to the way he wanted to play. And, you know, it's a gambit either way you look at it. You know, you could stick to your game plan, you could make changes, and one of them may not work out.
Yeah, I guess my issue isn't so much with the idea that Bertholder got out-coached, because you can make the argument he did. His tactics didn't work, the other coaches did. I think that my discontent with that story is the kind of vehement, oh, it happened again. You know, this wasn't necessarily the obvious he failed to make the adjustments like in week one. I think he did try to make adjustments. I just think he lacked that kind of firepower to make good adjustments, to make adjustments that would work. So I guess it's, to me, people are kind of making it sound like it's the same issue from week one, and I just don't necessarily agree with that. And part of the reason is, like I touched on, a couple of really key cogs to this Crew SC machine were missing last Saturday. Federico Higuain apparently aggravated and lingering ankle injury none of us were aware of. And Harrison Offal had a kitchen accident and sliced up his hand real good. So
wait. Backtrack. Is that really what happened?
As far as I'm aware, that was the story that came out. Harrison Offal cut a nerve in his hand cooking.
I heard he cut a nerve in his hand. I had no idea it was in the kitchen.
I don't think that I'm wrong about that. I feel like that's the story I heard. We will double check on that, but I'm pretty sure that's the story that is making the rounds right now.
I'm sure you're right, but that's just so, I don't know, unfortunate that it just almost doesn't even seem real. But
yeah, Jonathan Mensah was still out, but Alex Crenali has been deputizing well for him, so not really on the same level as Higuain and Offal. Hoping to have both of them back this week. No real confirmation either way from Berhalter today at practice. I was there. They didn't really have it open for us to see anything, so not really sure on their status. But as far as we know, the goal is to have them both back on track. Mensah, Berhalter's words when asked directly about Mensah, it's tight. It's going to be, you know, a tight decision. I don't think it's likely. He didn't sound particularly hopeful in that regard, but Crenali has deputized just fine, I think. But let's take a look at how Higuain's being missing last week really is what threw the crew SC lineup into disarray, I think. You know, for all the talk, I'm looking at you, MLS analyst, of Higuain being finished and needing to retire. I think last Saturday really proved that that's just not the case. This team looked a little lost in attack without him.
Sure. Pipa is a huge, huge part to this team offensively. He doesn't provide a ton defensively, but as far as offensive creation goes, he's the focal point to the attack. Even if he's not on the ball, it's his off-the-ball movements. And not having him against Chicago was a significant loss. Arthur played his position up top, which was the first time, I think, unless he played some in practice preseason, that he has played in that attacking midfield role. So a little bit of a different spot for him, and maybe it took him a little bit to adjust, but he did not look as productive as Higuain or as productive as he has in the past, playing a little bit deeper. Now also to touch on that a little bit, it wasn't a perfect 4-2-3-1 that we saw. It was more similar to a 4-3-3 from Columbus. Arthur did play a little bit higher than Trapp and Abu. He did play essentially a forward playmaking role. He would step out of the line, but it was a different role than Higuain was given. So if we saw the usual formation, the usual tactics that Berhalter's used to using, maybe that could work a little bit better. So, Chris, do you think it was a tactical thing as much as a personnel or a bit of both?
The struggles that they had, you mean?
Yeah.
I think it was just you had three very similar playmakers, players, playing in that central midfield, and Arthur didn't look to be pushing that high in the kind of the attacking midfield role that we're used to. So it was definitely much more flat, and I think it was just a combination of the players not necessarily being used to what they were being asked to do, particularly Abu, not to pile on him. I think he's a good player, but I think he had a poor performance on Saturday. And I think it was just the unfamiliarity and really almost too many cooks in the kitchen. Everybody was kind of playing the same way. Everybody was kind of reverting back to what they're used to doing. And it just it didn't have that impetus that the team needed. And so I think he put out the best lineup that he had available in his mind. I think if Kakuta Mane is available, you see a very different lineup. I think you see Justin Merrim in the Higuain role and Mane out wide, and maybe that's only for the first hour, and then they switch it up, you know, if Mane's not all the way fit, but Mane wasn't ready. And so Greg was forced to put out a lineup that probably wasn't his ideal lineup, no matter what he may say to the contrary. And I think he put out one that he thought could win, and it didn't end up working out for a number of reasons. You know, there's no one thing you can point at and say this is why it didn't work out. And I think something getting a little overlooked in all the Higuain talk, Harrison Offal brings a lot offensively to this team as well. Hector Giménez is a quality player. He's a Swiss Army knife player. He can play 5-6 positions probably throughout the park, but he doesn't bring the same oomph, for lack of a more technical term, to the right back position, that same aplomb that awful drives forward in. And I think, you know, the team could have used that spark on Saturday. Giménez didn't play poorly in my ratings. He wasn't great, but I don't think he played poorly. But there was just no spark for Crew SC's offense, and it's primarily because of the two guys they were missing.
Yeah, missing Offal obviously hurts. He's such a dynamic player. Of course, we had the American Kevin Grosskreutz in there instead, which, as you said, he's a utility player, so he's good for filling in.
Deep cuts on Massive Match Day this week. I think like maybe 5% of our audience is going to get that reference, but I approve.
All right.
Annotated. Well,
I think Giménez played well, but I see this as a, I don't know, again, as a team effort, and I don't like to label out individual players, and while missing those two obviously hurt in offensive production, I think overall, I think Berhalter kind of came out to throw a little bit of a curveball at Chicago, deploying more of a traditional 4-3-3, and we saw Chicago come out to start the match with a 3-5-2, where they had Michael DeLeo directly in the hole, David Akam and Nikolic up top. But I think 7 minutes into the game, if that...
It was very early.
Ponovic switched then to a 3-4-3 to then counter the 4-3-3 setup that Berhalter was using. And maybe Berhalter didn't expect him to make that change, at least that change that early. And that could have been why the game went so wayward. You also mentioned Mohamed Abu. He was playing a little bit out of position.
Yep.
He's used to playing that central holding midfield role in the 4-3-3, but we saw him on the side playing more of a center midfield role with Trapp in the center. And I think it was obvious that he felt a bit out of place.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think it's important to note for some of the fans who perhaps don't follow European leagues, who you know, maybe just getting into the game more. I know every time I go to the stadium, we see a lot of new fans, a lot of fans just starting to get their feet wet. It is important to differentiate. Just because two players are playing a similar position, you know, Will Trapp and Mohamed Abu are both playing central midfield, both primarily defensive midfielders, it's still important to note that their roles within the team, what they were being asked to do, were very different. And like you said, it's not a role Abu was used to being asked to play. He was more traditionally playing that Trapp role. You called it the water carrier in our chat. So I think that is definitely something to keep an eye on. And we talked about it a bit last year on the mothership. There's more than one way to play the playmaker role, the Higuain role. You know, Justin Merrim can slot in there, but he's a different type of player. So, and I think that's something that gets lost a little in some of the discussions about lineups and tactics, that just because someone's playing the same type of position, winger, attacking midfielder, holding midfielder, doesn't necessarily mean they're being asked to play the same role. And just because they can do one role in that position doesn't necessarily mean they can do the other roles in that position. So it's kind of hard on Abu to single him out, but he did look a little out of place. His passing did not look great.
And I don't fault him for it.
You can't fault him for it too much. You would still think a player of his caliber, a player of his pedigree, would be able to adjust a little more maybe than he did. But like you were saying, there was a switch in the formation for the opponents early on, and I think it just kind of disconcerted the Crew team, and they found themselves down a goal and unable to really fire back. And let's talk about the goal. It was, I lost the minute marker. It was first half goal.
It was in the 22nd
minute. 22nd minute. So, you know.
So I think it was like 21-21.
Thank you. Not too far into the game, less than a third of the way through the game. There's a good deal of blame to go around on this goal. This was, in all honesty, probably a preventable goal. Dax McCarty is given a lot of space to operate in, and as much as I hate the guy, good player, and he was able to exploit the space with a good pass, and then the shot came in, and you could argue that the young keeper, Stefan, could have done better there. The defenders could have stepped a little better there, so a lot of blame to go around. Your thoughts on the goal we conceded?
So I think what it comes down to is what we call positional superiority, which is something that Chicago was able to achieve for much of the match. They were able to keep numbers high while also keeping players behind the ball as a safeguard and forcing Columbus to compress defensively. So in this goal, there was 11 players behind the ball for Columbus, and I think the closest player to the halfway line was Ola Kamara, and he was about 15 to 18 yards away.
That's entirely too deep for a Berhalter system. That is way deeper than they like to play.
Sure. I mean, that's almost like Diego Simeone, like Atletico Madrid-esque. And yeah, that's they need some pressure on the center back. So I'm looking at a picture I have here, just a game cap, and they're I think it's Dax on the ball, and there's three center backs basically around him, all with space. So if Dax gets closed down, he can't make that vertical pass. He has the safeguard, and they can keep possession. There is some benefit to keeping that compression, but you also have to be applying enough pressure. And nobody was pressuring Dax in that instance. And he was able to pick out that pass, and there was a large hole in the defense, and found Nikolić going through.
And Nikolić knew what to do with it. All the warnings that were given about his quality turned out to be kind of true. So after the goal, Kruse conceded. Chicago, I don't want to say they parked the bus, because it's not quite the full-on parking the bus situation. But they were content to really pack the lines, to really keep things tight, and they weren't super interested in rampaging forward, really. Kruse managed to create some chances after switching to they brought on Nico Hansen. Let me find my notes. I believe it was sometime around the 65th minute. It was 60th minute. It was Hansen. 60th. Hansen came on, Merrim went into that playmaker role, the Higuain role, for lack of a better term, and they went back to that more traditional Berhalter system, and they looked much more comfortable. And they started to get a little bit going, but Bridgeview were just kind of shutting it down. Ethan Finley, who's taken a lot of heat this year, had two real good rampages down the right wing, a couple of crosses pulled back that no one was in the right place for. Why was no one there?
Again, I think that goes back to just the positional nature of the game. And Chicago had Columbus playing really deep for most of the match. When Columbus would attack, they were able to get a few numbers forward, but they weren't really attacking as a unit. And inside the box, it left Ola Kamara, and that was about it.
So Finley didn't really get his head up on the cross, but you don't think that really had anything to do with it? Finley put the ball in the right place, and it just wasn't the right run?
Well, I think he didn't have the support entirely, and I think what he was asked to do, Finley made some really good runs during the match, and I don't think he had the support in the center of the field necessary to make those adequate crosses. Now, of course, you know, Finley has been criticized of putting his head down and dribbling maybe a little bit too much, but overall I thought he played pretty well. I just thought he was too isolated.
He created the two best chances for Crew FC in that one, so yeah. I mean, you can't really fault him too much on this occasion.
Sure, but I forgot he was on the field
for long periods of time.
Because he was so isolated out there, and even when he got the ball, there wasn't much he could do with it.
I think more than anyone, with all the tweaks that Berhalter has made game in, game out this season, you know, we've seen something a little different each game. I think Finley has been affected most out of any of the players. You know, Artur has been asked to do a lot of different things, but I think just by nature of what changes Greg is making, I think Finley's role has been so different each game that it's hard for Finley to to look good at times because he's being asked to do so much different. And I am far from a Finley defender. I have gotten some heat for my my attacks, air quotes, on Ethan in the past. But I think it's hard to fault Finley at times this season because he's doing a lot that is not necessarily being stat worthy and noticed for this team, the way he's changing his role. And for the most part, you know, he's been effective. So it makes me feel kind of bad for him almost that he hasn't had that moment of, oh, there's that wonder play from Finley that we've seen perhaps in 2014, 2015. Looking at my notes from the end of the game here, Bridgeview started going for the dagger, you know, just kill it off around the 85th minute. Nico Nace continued to play those big Hollywood switches that drive both of us batty. And then my final note for the night, and maybe this is a little harsh, but 90+3, this is my final note for the game. Mr. Excitement, Adam John, is terrible. Does Adam John bring anything to this Crew team?
Wow, that one, just you threw that right out there. I thought last year he was pretty productive. I thought that defensively especially, he adds a lot. I see him as a player that comes in at a forward role when the team is winning and the team needs to defend, or if the team needs to press heavily, because I think his defensive positioning and his defensive mindset is a bit better than Ola Kamara's. That being said, offensively, I don't think he necessarily fits this team.
Does he start to lose minutes with Kakuta Mane coming into the fold?
I think definitely, yeah.
Well, there you go. I'm just trying to get the nickname Mr. Excitement over. It's nothing personal towards him. He's apparently a very nice guy. But, yeah, I just like the nickname Mr. Excitement. So, Nate, anything to add on last Saturday's trip to the Windy City or thereabouts?
Can we forget that game happened?
I assume. Well, considering the main podcast decided to just say screw it, we didn't have enough to talk about this week.
I think they were trying. That's why we got stuck with it, right?
I volunteered us to be stuck with it, honestly, because I had a hot take about Mr. Excitement that I needed to get out there. All right, so we are going to take a brief detour. Usually we go straight into previewing this week's game, but we're going to take a brief detour and go around the league here. We're going to take a look at where Crew SC are in the standings, who's around them, some of the trends in the league, and just do a quick jump around. Shouldn't take too long, so just jump forward a couple minutes in your feed if you have no interest in anyone not named Crew SC. But I think it's important, we're a month into the season, to get a little context about where Crew SC are standing. And as of right now, unless Google apparently does the standings right there when you research Major League Soccer into Google, but according to Google, top of the East still. Crew SC, 6 games played, 9 goals for, 7 goals against, 10 points. They are still, by a point, top of the league, or not top of leagues, pardon me, top of the East.
Sure, but about everybody below Crew SC has at least one game in hand, except for New York Red Bulls.
Yes.
And Orlando has 2.
Orlando has 2. And with the exception of the game against Crew SC, they've won all 3 of their other games they've played. So Orlando, Atlanta, both looking like legitimate threats here early on in the season. Bridgeview, surprisingly enough, or maybe not, you know, they've taken 4 points from Crew SC already through, and they're sitting right there in the mix as well. Who stands out to you on this list as a surprise?
Well, I think Atlanta United is, you know, for what they've done in their first season in MLS, they've been extremely impressive. Their offense is tremendous to watch. Maybe it shouldn't be too surprising. They have Tata Martino at their helm, and they have assembled a really good team. But for a first team in MLS, it's very impressive nonetheless.
13 goals and, 4 already.
Yeah, and Chicago's blown me away too, to be honest. Even though their goal differential is still negative, maybe that's something that will never change about them. they've still played far, far better than they did last season. So they're obviously making good moves there. Also surprise on the, you know, the other side would be New York Red Bulls. They seem like they can't get it together. And I have some thoughts on that if you'd like me to share.
Absolutely. No, go for it now. We're going around the league. Hit me with your Red Bull thoughts.
All right. So my Red Bull thoughts are that it's the corporation's fault. And maybe I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I think it definitely has some substance to it. So obviously Red Bull owns the New York Red Bulls. They also own Red Bull Salzburg in Austria, and they own Red Bull Leipzig in Germany, and I think a few other teams as well. But those are the big ones. Anyway, they give each of their teams a packet, like a, brochure, like guidelines that they have to follow. These are like coaching standards, these are training standards, etc., that they have to abide by. And from my understanding, the coaching staff can differ from it in some exceptions, but there are some things that they have to follow. They don't really have much of a choice. And this comes from the board of Red Bull, the same board that owned the energy drink company. So apparently they all think they know something about soccer. Anyway, I guess it's worked for Leipzig, but they have a team that's built around that. And I think the board thinks that this strategy is the, like, total ultimate strategy for everything soccer. So I think they've been trying to bring that to New York. And with that, I think that is why we've seen New York Rebels in a 4-2-2-2. A la Leipzig and Salzburg style. It doesn't suit this team. It doesn't suit players like Sasha Kljestan because he can't play his central playmaking role. It suits a team like Leipzig really well, but it does not suit this New York team at all. In the second half, we've seen them switching to a 4-2-3-1, and maybe they have to use that formation for one half. I'm not sure, but I think the corporation's to the fault, and that's why New York Red Bulls are sinking this year. There, end rant.
Wow, I did not know what to expect when I said, give me a Red Bull take, but that was not it. That is the first I've heard of that theory, and I don't even know what to think about that. That is, it sounds almost ridiculous, but then again, all the ridiculous stuff we see in football and in Major League Soccer. I'm going to have to do some digging on that one. I'm sure we'll discuss this again as the matches with Red Bull New York approach. Yes, Patrick Murphy, I'm going to say Red Bull New York because Murph and I just discussed this at practice today.
It should be Red Bull New York. Yeah.
Switching focus from conspiracies to the Western Conference of MLS. No real conspiracy here. Minnesota United are terrible.
Yeah, there's not much else to say about that.
Six matches, 22 goals conceded already. I believe that is still a record pace for worst season. Most goals conceded, all that kind of stuff. On the other end of that, only two goals conceded for FC Dallas. They sit in second place behind Portland, but have played two fewer games. The West, everything's pretty bunched up because it's a league based on parity on both sides of the coin, but Portland obviously lost to the Crew. Dallas look real good as well. Their defense only conceding two goals. Sporting Kansas City have only conceded two goals, and that's in one more match. So there are some good teams on both sides of the coin this year, and it's not the traditional, superpowers that we expect. LA Galaxy, Seattle Sounders, both kind of right in the middle of the pack in the West. Thoughts on what's going down out West right now?
Well, out in the West, it's a bit of a mixed bag. Obviously, Portland's a good team. They've had some slouch matches this year, but overall, they're super fun to watch. They have new pieces in there, like Sebastian Blanco, who, if you read any of my stuff, I've talked about him endlessly. He's just really fun to watch.
Bit of a crush.
Dallas has played solid. Yeah, it's man crush for sure. FC Dallas has played solid. Houston has been insanely impressive. They have 3 wins. They have 11 goals in their 5 matches. And Kubo Torres has been electric. Then towards the bottom of the table, we see Colorado Rapids, who I don't know what's going on there. I think reality has finally hit Pablo Mascherini. and hopefully he's finally realizing that in order to win soccer games, you do in fact need a midfield. You can't just have defenders and forwards. It worked for a few games last year. I don't think it's going to work anymore because that's not how you play soccer, but I'll hold back. In Real Salt Lake, they have new coach Mike Pecky. And for those of you who watched the Snow Bowl against Vancouver, it was a fun match to watch, and I think he can do something in Real Salt Lake. They look pretty good in that game comparatively to the rest of their season.
What match was it where Nick Raimondo just lost his mind and had like two terrible turnovers leading to goals? Was that that match or was that a different match?
Oh, that was like every match this season.
What happened to
that
Nick
Raimondo? That was LA Galaxy.
That was the Galaxy game. What has happened to Nick Raimondo? Was he like, oh, well, Timmy Howard came back to the national team. He came to MLS. My spot's gone. Whoop. You know, what is going on? Is that just a slump?
I don't really know. I think that he thinks he's like Kaka or Neymar with his footwork. Because against Vancouver in the snow, he tried that same move that killed him in against the LA Galaxy. That fancy little like turn, Cruyff turn. I don't even remember what it was. But he tried the same thing against Vancouver and barely got away with it.
There's a very short list of players who I would trust to pull off a Cruyff turn in the snow, and I'm sorry, Mr. Raimondo, you're not on it. Yeah, it's been an interesting year so far around the league. Obviously, this weekend, Crew are taking on Toronto, who are towards the bottom of the pack in the East, but it's a very crowd. They're really more towards the middle. Basically, it's 10 points for Crew, 9 for Orlando, sure. 8 for Bridgeview and Atlanta, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teams all on 7 points, and then you fall off a cliff and have Montreal and Philadelphia. So Toronto could very easily jump to the top of the pack with a convincing win at the fray, and that's what we're going to talk about now. This weekend, Sebastian Giovinco, Josie Altidore, Michael Bradley, and their whole menagerie come down to the fray to take on the Crew. Giovinco, obviously one of, if not the best players in MLS. Greg Berhalter spoke today about just how dangerous a team Toronto are. He said they have probably the best attacking tandem in Altidore and Giovinco in the league. And he said they're hard to stop. You just gotta, again, you just gotta try to contain them. You gotta try to keep them as under wraps as you can and be prepared for when they hit you. Nate, what do you think the key to containing, I'm not going to say stopping, containing the TFC show is?
Don't allow Sebastian Giovinco time on the ball.
Oh, simple. All right. Well, show over. We got this.
Yep. Real simple. I think how you're going to do that is don't let him get the ball. Again, real simple. I know. It's going to come back to team defending. It's going to be similar, I think, to the Orlando match. Mm-hmm. And how they set up, you know, it was very similar there, well, in my mind. You don't let Kyle Larin get the ball. It's kind of similar here. And for the most part, they didn't really let Larin get the ball in that match. And when he did, he was kind of isolated out wide. So force Giovinco to go wider. Don't let him play in the center of the pitch.
A little different challenge from this one. Toronto play a back three / back five almost exclusively. Got to speak to Josh Williams a little at practice today. He was obviously a part of that TFC team last year. I asked him, who is kind of the wild card? What everyone focuses so much on the big three for Toronto. What could be a wild card for Toronto that people need to be more aware of? And he said the way that back line play. They've played together for a while now. They're very good. Their wing backs get really high up the field. Their back three are really good in possession. So I think this is going to be definitely a game where defending from the front is going to be important. Obviously, we're hoping Higuain plays. Higuain's fit, you know, to pressure like he sometimes does, because I think that cutting off the supply, making supply hard from the back to the midfield, will definitely slow down the midfield to the forwards. You know, if you can force them to go long and bypass the midfield, you've got a better chance, I think, of stopping the dangerous playmakers. Obviously, you have Bradley pulling the strings, so keeping the back three from getting the ball to Bradley could very well be could be vital. And I think it is a little different from the Orlando game. You mentioned the Orlando game being similar, deny the playmakers the ball. But much of the danger, as you pointed out, was coming from wide in the Orlando game. And with the back three, back five, I'm not entirely sure that that danger is going to be kind of coming from the same way, because they have so many different options through the middle. You know, Giovinco can drop deep, Bradley can push up. There's a lot of option there where Orlando played almost exclusively one way.
I think we do know a little bit of what to expect from Toronto. While their positional movements may be a little bit undetermined, we know, like you said, that they're going to throw a three in the back. And it is pretty interesting to watch them and how their players move around the field. Against Atlanta, Toronto looked pretty good, I think, for the first time this season. Prior to that, they looked, it was inconclusive whether or not they were a decent team or not, I think. But having Seba and Josie up top, obviously, is, you know, huge to that team. But I think defensively, or offensively, but from their defenders, it was interesting to watch as Chris Mavinga would come up into the midfield line to add another center midfielder during the attack. He's a left-sided center back. And I think Columbus may have a little bit of issue with that.
Yeah.
With the center backs coming up into the midfield. We saw it a little bit from Chicago, and Columbus didn't know how to handle it. The way they handled it was by more vertical compression. And as we saw, that didn't work out too well. So I think in order to counter it in Toronto, they're going to have to keep pressure on that back line and can't sit back as deep.
Do you think that this might be a match where we see Cruessi roll out a back three, back five sort of scenario?
I think so. Yeah, especially with the two-striker front of Sebastian Giovinco and Josie Altidore. I think we see three in the back. We're probably not going to see Jonathan Mensah.
Yep.
So we could throw Josh Williams in there on the side of Crenali and Nico Nace.
And Williams did play for Toronto last year, so, you know.
Sure.
He kind of downplayed the significance of that. You know, everybody knows how everybody plays, he said. And you obviously try to change it up game in, game out, let alone year in, year out. But it could be an interesting wrinkle if we do see the three at the back. Williams, obviously the favorite to be that third man if Jonathan is out, as he was in D.C. You know, it's kind of the same question as last week. Mane, if he's ready to go, Berhalter seems to be hopeful that he's ready to go. Do you see him? Where do you see him playing in this matchup in particular? Where would he be most effective in your mind?
Well, I don't see Berhalter starting him.
Mm-hmm.
Given Berhalter's history, he likes to start people off in the bench, kind of ease them in the system a little bit rather than throwing a wrench in there entirely. Well, I thought we were going to see him last week. But we didn't.
Didn't even travel.
So hopefully we see a substitute appearance this week. But I think Columbus probably will go three in the back with their 3-4-2-1 setup. With, I assume, Merrim and Higuain behind Ola Kamara. And then I guess Raitsela, Awful, Archer, and Trapp in the midfield line. So I would see Mane coming on. He could really come on for anyone in the top three as the substitute.
I have not got to see him play very much. Has he played that kind of playmaker role, the kind of in a three system, you know, with the Christmas tree or spaceship formation, Higuain or Merrim? Has he played that role, or is he usually more of the point of the spear, so to speak?
He has played out wide. I wouldn't necessarily call him a playmaker. I call him a difference maker. But
like
he isn't a guy who's going to get behind the ball and spray passes in. So if he came on for Higuain, he would have a significantly different role, even though he'd be in the same position, going back to that distinction of positions and roles.
Yep. Another question. We saw Waylon Francis come on for Yuka Raitala last week. He came on in the, looking back at my notes here, my apologies. He came on in the 73rd minute. it was as Crew were pushing to try to get a goal to equalize, it appeared that Berhalter was hoping for some better crossing coming through. Do you think that Raitala's place in the first 11 might be under threat here, or was that just a change-up, roll-the-dice sort of try-to-get-a-spark move?
I don't think his place is in question. I think he's played very well this season. But to be honest, and maybe you can explain it to me further, but that substitute did not seem to make much sense to me.
I think they were looking for more creativity from somewhere. I think Waylon has shown in the past that he's got the ability to get down the field, get crosses in. A few minutes later, they did bring on Mr. Excitement to try to be kind of the target man. My only thought was a better crossing. I don't think Raitala's crossing has been bad, but, you know, Waylon has a history of serving some good balls on occasion. Other times, they're terrible. Inconsistency is probably why he lost the gig to begin with. And
so I'm looking up the stats right now, and Waylon had one cross. He attempted six passes and only completed three of them. He did not win any challenges, but he lost two, and conceded one foul and had one interception.
Well, that is not super awesome. Could have also been legs. Raitala could have just been tired, you know.
Sure.
Those stats kind of speak for themselves, though. So that puts the kibosh on my question of did Raitala lose his spot. I don't think you can really make the case for Waylon on those numbers.
Raitala had seven long balls in the match. That's a lot.
That is a lot, especially for a Berhalter team.
And three key passes, which is also a substantial number. That's huge.
Harrison didn't play. Never mind. I'd be interested. We should do some research for next week. Go back and look at what the average for both of those stats is for Harrison for the first few matches of the year. Because Raitala was kind of brought in to be the kind of counterbalance to Harrison. You know, he's a similar type of player in skill set and in mentality. And he was kind of brought in to counterbalance the wings, you know, and add that offensive presence on the left side. So I'd be interested in doing a kind of side-by-side comparison for those two. So do you have, we already kind of talked about the key to stopping Toronto. What do Crew SC have to do offensively this game to get something going against this Toronto back five, back three?
They need to create better chances and support better in the attack. As I said, with the Chicago match, the likes of Ethan Finley were far too isolated outside, and because of their vertical compression defensively, they weren't getting adequate numbers forward in the attack. And when they had attacking chances, they were limp chances, you know, where they had two, maybe three players going in on the attack, where we've seen from Columbus far better success when they attack as a unit, move the ball a lot better, a lot more interplay, and can be more dynamic in the attack. We didn't see that against Chicago, and we need to see that against Toronto.
Yeah, I agree. There was just no real spark for much of the game against Bridgeview, and hopefully Higuain will be back and ready to play at least the majority of the game. Maybe we'll see Mane. I think the formation change could prove good. You know, it worked kind of, sort of, against DC. We didn't really have much creativity, but got a couple penalties. But they've obviously had, you know, another almost month to work out some of the kinks. So I'm interested to see how the team lines up, personnel-wise, formation-wise. Predictions. I wish I was more confident in this one about Cruessi's chances, but I see this one being a close-fought battle, and I think I see the Hosers getting the win 2-1 to Toronto, as much as it pains me to admit it.
Wow.
I know.
I don't know what I expected you to say, but
it physically hurt
you to say that.
I have a story, and fans who have not been around for a long time won't remember. There was a time when Toronto could not buy a win in Crew Stadium. And Duncan Auten, who was the commentator here at the time before he left for Toronto to take up a coaching role, I was walking the upper concourse leaving the game, and Duncan was walking out of the booth, and I've seen him around. We would hang out at the same drinking establishment for a while. And we were walking out, and he was like, "Great match, huh? Crew just won, obviously." And I was like, "Dude, if I ever have to sit through a Toronto win at this stadium, I'm gonna just throw myself off the balcony, off the concourse, rather than walk down, because I just won't be able to live with it." And then he broke my heart and moved to Toronto to be a coach, and now he's dead to me. That's my story.
Well, yeah. that's something.
I'm just kidding. I miss you, Duncan.
Well, as far as my prediction goes, I'm saying the flip of that. I'm saying Kruse 2.
Really?
Toronto 1.
Wow. Well, that is, I think this is the first time we've actually disagreed on a result. We've disagreed on scores, but I think this is the first time we've disagreed on result.
Declaring war now, Chris. I got to get those magical fantasy points somehow, right? And if we keep agreeing,
yeah,
it's not going to happen.
Yes, exactly. All right, well, that was this week's special Extendo-matic edition of Massive Match Day. We do have one more little wrinkle we want to throw out here for you. We are thinking about throwing this out there every week. If you have a question about this team, specifically its tactics, how they're playing, how a player is performing, something a little more X's and O's orientated, we'd love to hear from you. We're going to call it Massive Mailbag or Match Day Mailbag or one of those alliterative type names. Drop us a line on Twitter. I am at Chris Landis, KRISLANDIS. He is at Glory to Columbus. We would love to hear from you. You can leave us a comment on the website as well. But get at us. Let us know what questions you want to see tackled on the show. We're trying to find some wrinkles here to make this a little more interesting rather than just two dudes talking about soccer. We want to say thank you again to our sponsors, Old North Arcade and the Land Grant Brewing Company. Land Grant apparently are launching a brand new beer on Friday. It's apparently a blueberry ale of some sort, and it sounds really interesting, and I'm trying to figure out a way to work from the field tomorrow so I can go try that. So go give their taproom a shot, find them in the stores, they're everywhere, and they make good beer. For Nathaniel Marhefka, I am Chris Landis. Have fun at the fray this weekend, stay safe, don't punch any Mounties, and tune in next week, and as always, stay massive.